Hello, I'm Paddy O'Connell. This is an archive edition of Alistair Cook's Letter from America. It was recorded by one of two listeners who between them taped and labelled more than 650 Letter from America programmes from 1973 to 1989. Terms and conditions for this download can be found on the BBC website, along with many more editions of this programme, thanks to those two men.
Good evening. A cab driver who picks me up from time to time was unusually cheerful the other day. It was one of those New York winter days, bright as a jewel but sharp as a knife, when even crossing the sidewalk to jump in a cab is like leaping from a refrigerator into an oven. End of February, most of March, the man said, is the worst time. Brutal. But me, I'm off to Florida. I said, just in time for Super Tuesday, which is the day, the 8th of March, when 20 southern states will hold presidential primaries. I tell you something, the man said. That's the only bad part. I'd like to run away from the whole damn business till July. Then have somebody tell me who they've picked, both of them. One of the nagging things about living in New York City is that you can never really settle into a northern winter because it's an on-again, off-again climate. You may wake up to a warm, wet wind from the south, or a cold wind from the northeast, or 6 inches of snow from the west, or anything in between. My daughter, 400 miles to the north of us, in Vermont, lives on no such seesaw. Comes December, and the land is blanketed and will be through March, maybe April. She sounded as merry as a cricket the other morning. She has a small truck for her five children, high-axled, snow tires, four-wheel brakes being compulsory if you're going to crunch and lurch through the country roads, if indeed you're going to go on living your life. She'd just driven the two boys 20 miles off to school and was now dressing up the three small girls in their Eskimo winter uniforms and taking them out to ski and sled. They just had a 2-day snowfall of 20 inches on a powder base, and the sun was bright and it was 21 below zero. What do you call that in England, she said. If they had it, I said, it would be 53 degrees below freezing. So what had she been up to? Oh, the usual, up at 5:30, stoke the furnace, clean out the horses' stables, breakfast for 7, school, shop for dinner. 6 friends were dropping in. Then she had to write a short sermon for next Sunday's church, then cook for the 13 of them. What do you do in your spare time? You kidding, she said. She's taking a bachelor's degree in English and American literature at Vermont College. Have a happy, I said, and turned up the radiator and buried myself in the New York Times. It was after that that I ran into my cab driver licking his lips over his imminent departure for Florida, which led me, when I was home again, to look up a favorite old book, an enormous Economic History of North America by a great man, Professor J. Russell Smith, now long gone. An economic history sounds heavy going, but this old man carried a load of knowledge, very likely, and had a tart wit that passed over even into the photographs which illustrate his huge tome. Here, for instance, I'm at a chapter entitled Subtropic Coasts and the Florida Peninsula, and looking at a photograph to illustrate Florida's chief crop and chief source of income. It's a sharp picture of a beach and the aquamarine ocean beyond, and in the foreground, 4 sparkling palm trees with half-naked couples lazing under them. The caption says, "The healthy condition of these small palm trees is proof that repeated photographing does not injure a tree." If he were writing the caption today, he might well have added, the Chamber of Commerce has seen to it that the camera did not veer slightly to the right. Otherwise, we should have seen trucks pounding along a four-lane highway. Now, of course, Florida is big enough, it's slightly larger than England, to have much backcountry, great forests, and a long inland stretch of lake country. But it's southern Florida and its coastline that has attracted, since the Second War, enough northerners, and in the past few years, refugee Cubans, Mexicans, other Hispanics, to make the population of Florida quintuple in just over 30 years. In 1950, 2 millions. In 1980, 10 millions. Now, 13 and rising. But the advertising men still control our imaginations. It used to be in print, now it's on television. They make the stereotypes and blind us with them, so that you say, Florida, and it's still the aquamarine sea and the palm trees, and nubile girls with carefree, bronzed men. And, of course, it's the same for the pictures that Americans keep at the back of their minds for the regions of the rest of the country. In a continental country of this size, you'd go mad trying to juggle the complexities of the real thing. This past week, for instance, we've been saturated every evening with reports on the spot of the presidential candidates of both parties bending into the bitter winds or clomping through the snows of New Hampshire. Every broadcast of one network ended with a symbolic picture of New Hampshire. Sometimes it was two horses in a snowfield by an old barn. Next night, a forest of snow-laden birches against a background of blue mountains. Next night, a slender 18th-century colonial white-wooded church. Just what everybody knows to be typical of the life and landscape of New Hampshire. Nothing, however, could be more false to the New Hampshire of today. Over 30 years ago, I was up there for the New Hampshire primary, and I noted then the forests of white birch, the gurgling rivers, the folding snowfields, the white wooden houses, as well as the shabby capital city of Concord and the grimy industrial town of Manchester. But at the end of a day, when I'd gone mushing through the Arctic with now forgotten political giants, I remember old Senator Taft, I came to a village that was no more than a few wide lanes of white houses in moon-white fields. There was an old colonial church with leaded windows and a soaring spire, and the place was ablaze with light. In the basement, where the heating pipes were sizzling against the ceiling, there were about 100-120 people, farmers in leather jackets and plaid shirts, roadmen in peaked caps, women in cloth coats and bandanas, girls in ski pants and windbreakers, tradesmen, a teacher or two. They were about to hold a meeting, a special meeting of a sort which, by Act of Parliament in 1774, was banned throughout New England as a revolutionary and powerful force. So it was. The annual town meeting, at which everybody from the parson to the street sweeper votes on an agenda that has gone out to every family in the town. It's a fat, printed booklet accounting for every nickel spent in the past year on everything from rates to dog licenses and fuel for the Grange Hall. Tonight, all these citizens would vote on how the following year's nickels and dimes and dollars were to be spent. In colonial times, and 30 years ago, and today, no town in New Hampshire is governed by elected officials. This annual town meeting does it. Everybody votes on whether to have a new hospital, an increase in rates, how much for old age assistance? How much to mend the cracked flagpole by the church? They parceled out, I see, $67 to an asphalt company, $240 to one man for unspecified labor. He bore, by the way, the splendid name of Exist Champagne. One-third of New Hampshire's people are descended from French Canadians. All right, next item, the cemetery. How much for upkeep? Wrecking company for this and that. Money to mend the covered bridges damaged in a ferocious winter storm and so on. On and on to a fierce squabble over the bounty to be paid to every boy who brought in a dead porcupine, which is a damaging pest in those parts. Some boys had brought in only tails, which can be ingeniously manufactured. It was voted that they had to deliver also the nose and the whiskers. And when it was all done, a budget of over $76,000 was passed for the coming year. Three so-called select men, or select men, were then chosen to carry out the decisions of this one-day, almost alarmingly democratic parliament. Well, that was, as I say, over 30 years ago, but that institution, government of the towns by town meeting, is still the rule. It's one of the few colonial survivors and one of the few reminders of the New Hampshire of long ago and not so long ago. Today, this still beautiful state, pictured every night through its farms and the wren spires of its old churches, has less than 10% of its land in farms. Only one other of the 50 states is more industrialized. When I talked about that town meeting, New Hampshire was a poor, rural state. Today, it's a prosperous state. Its unemployment rate, 2%, is the lowest in the nation. It had 150,000 people in 1790. In 1980, not much more than twice as many. Today, 8 years later, 1 million. The sons of the old textile workers now make microchips, plastics, electronics, high-tech. The average income, $15,000 per person, is the eighth highest in the country. It has no state income tax, no sales taxes. It is still heavily Republican, though an influx of 100,000 blue-collar workers from Massachusetts to the South may swell a little the Democratic vote. Only a little, because the blue-collar vote in New Hampshire is still more Republican than Democratic. And the Republicans there, oblivious of the teaching of liberal columnists that Mr. Reagan is an old, doddering, lame duck, approve of him in his job by 80%, which is 15% higher than his popularity rating over the whole nation. Even that, 65%, is something to ponder when you consider that it's higher than that of any president in living memory at the end of his second term. So, no wonder, in spite of all the expert predictions to the contrary, no wonder Republicans went solidly for Mr. Reagan's man, Vice President Bush. New Hampshire, conservative, tiny, no doubt very unrepresentative, is still living in what it takes to be Ronald Reagan's golden age. Good night.
That was an archive edition of Letter from America by Alistair Cook. You can listen to thousands more programs on the BBC Radio 4 website.